On Mars with Matt and Hillary. It's not attractive to cough. I apologize to the authors of the works that we'll be discussing today for doing that to them. But it's Marooned on Mars, Matt and Hillary. I'm Matt.
I'm Hillary.
And we're back with our science. It's began as a Kim Stanley Robinson. It began as a Mars trilogy podcast.
Yes.
A Kim Stanley Robinson podcast. And then for a minute there, it was an aliens podcast.
Yeah.
And now it's a science fiction podcast, but it'll be a Kim Stanley Robinson podcast again in the future. But right now, right, Hillary?
Yes.
But right now, for the next, we're going to do a brief series of, collections of short stories recently published, because right now we're going to be discussing the newly released, I guess it came out in August, Tomorrow's Parties, Life in the Anthropocene, edited by Jonathan Strahan. And then the next episode I think we're going to try to do is going to be on Everything for Everyone.
Yeah, that would be fun, which I think is a novel. But I mean, but
it is a novel. It's not a collection of short stories. Yeah, it feels like a collection of short stories because it's an oral history
of the New York Commune, right? Written by Emmy O'Brien and Iman Abdelhadi.
Yeah.
A really just like marvelous utopian book. Yeah. And this book, Tomorrow's Parties, which is out from MIT Press and is part of a series. I mean, I don't know how long MIT Press has been like publishing science fiction. They're the ones who are putting out the new translations of Stanislaw Lem.
Oh.
I don't know if I've said that on the podcast before, but like it's amazing to read new translations of Lem. I mean, they're extremely different.
Okay.
They just feel really, really different. I think that the translations of him into English had been ones that were translated like not directly from the Polish, but from French translations. So yeah, they were like, you know, third hand translations or whatever. And I don't know quite what's happening, like how many of these there will be. I've read two or maybe three of them and they're really, really good. They feel very like, yeah, it's actually quite, they feel like very different stylistically than my memories of reading Lem before. But yeah, so I guess MIT Press is doing some science fiction, and the person who is director of marketing at MIT Press reached out to us on Twitter and offered us a copy of this collection, Tomorrow's Parties. And that was convenient because also I wanted to look at it anyway because I was thinking there might be something for the sort of SF in the capitalist scene class that I'm teaching next quarter. So we got these books for free. So
this whole thing is a paid advertisement. We were paid in books.
Advertisement for a book.
Yeah. And we were paid in books.
We got paid in books.
Specifically this book.
Yeah. We got paid in two books to talk about a book.
But honestly, I would recommend, I mean, if you're into this kind of thing, and if you're listening to this podcast, you probably are.
Yeah.
Then yeah, I would recommend it.
It has an interview with our friend Kim Stanley Robinson in it.
That's right.
Which I would say is an interview that if you have paid any attention to what Stan has been talking about in the last 2 to 3 years, is not going to have any shockers in it. I mean, it's a smart interview. This is not to say that it's not a smart interview, but it is probably terrain that listeners of this podcast are familiar with. The collection has, it's funny. I was just thinking that I'm a novel person. I love novels. And that's my favorite form of SF is the novel. I like an extended narration. You know, I mean, even better than just one novel. What if there were three novels? Mm-hmm. You know,
and they were each 1,000 pages long.
And they were each 1,000 pages long, and we did a podcast about them. But you know, like often I think science fiction short story collections are slightly disappointing, right? You know, I feel like you either get them because, like, oh, there's some story that didn't come out in any other place and you're trying to find it, or you get them for historical interest, like the Harlan Ellison Dangerous Visions anthologies, which, if you know, like, if you're into like the new wave, like, those are incredibly interesting, like, documents. But it's like a rare SF short story collection that I feel like, to me, feels super satisfying. You know, mm-hmm. they're like usually a couple of hits, and then and you know, then a lot of like, well, that's fine. But this, I think this is a good one. And, you know, it's not long, but I feel like it feels like a lot there. Yeah. It feels like a lot goes on in it.
I think like the majority of them are really, I mean, I enjoyed all of them. And I think, and we're not going to talk about every single entry in the book, because that would just take in the anthology, because that would just take too long. But I think one of the things that makes the collection really compelling is that it really feels like a collection, that there's a lot of like, sort of intersections between the stories, and you can almost pair them up really nicely, or put them into dialogue, I guess it was what I'm trying to say, in interesting ways, because I feel like almost all of them, if not all of them, deal like really specifically with a lot of the issues that we discuss on the podcast, which are political economy, political economy mixed with the environment, right? Like eco-economics, that concept all the way back from Red Mars. And they're all set in either the near or the far future.
Yeah.
And really do a kind of like, you know, vivid imagining of those kinds of future worlds in which capitalism is more or less, well, is either dominant or is either still dominant or is residual in some way, right? Yeah. And that there is always something new emerging. And then within that, the stories themselves are extremely human as well. And I hate that phrase when people say like, oh, like an actor usually will say, these characters are so human.
It's
like,
human.
Well, what the fuck else would they be? But what I mean by that is that a lot of them have, or they all have the kind of similar, you know, human relationships that we are used to experiencing in capitalism, tensions between generations, between sexes and genders, and around concepts of age, and these things that are more or less artificial that capitalism imposes upon us, but that nevertheless still here have life, and this kind of residual and sort of lived in, another phrase I hate, quality to them, right?
Yeah. I think it's really nicely put. I was gonna highlight two things that I think, or maybe three things. One is that the blurb, whatever you call the little like blurb of praise on the cover, I guess that's just a blurb, is from Nature, for the series that this book is in, which is called 12 Tomorrows. Mm-hmm. And the praise is hard sci-fi at its best, which I find actually, like, you know, I mean, as I've said ad nauseum on this podcast, I hate that distinction, which I think is, you know, primarily about dismissing SF written by people who are not, basically by people who are not white men.
Right.
Although there are plenty of white men who also write non-hard SF too. Mm-hmm. I think it's a bad distinction. I think it's a distinction that like inflates what technology is. And also, like, it's a very funny thing to have on the cover of this book, which really is very much, I think, as you were just saying, like, it is quite interested in trying to do, even in the stories that are like kind of the wackiest, you know, it really wants to, like, pretty much every story is quite interested in human relations in a very like kind of daily sort of way. So in the intro, Strahan writes, He's saying something about you know, in the interview with Robinson, he suggests the COVID-19 pandemic shows there's reason for some optimism in our situation. We can kind of bracket whether we think that that is true or not. And optimism that people across the world can work together on a global scale that might even address the problems that we face, can find ways for people to live and even thrive as the planet faces changes it cannot avoid. And that's where Tomorrow's Parties, this book, comes in. I wanted to give you a glimpse of what life might be like, however improbable, however bleak, as we live with climate change in the future. What, I asked, would education, raising a family, building a home, doing any of the small day-to-day parts of life look like? And I got some incredible responses. And I mean, and you know, I think that that's a really great, you know, I like that that was the sort of like impulse here. And then I think it's interesting, you know, that he wants specifically after that to say these are not stories, are not material for doom scrolling, but he also wants to say they're not hope punk. I mean, maybe he wants to say they're not hope punk just because like that's such a stupid formulation. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting that here, I mean, maybe this is a sort of like product of like, you know, moderation, but like, it's interesting that he wants to say like, you know, we can think about, we can think hard about what it might be life like for life to continue without having to sort of like take up either it's going to be good or it's going to be terrible position, right? You know, there are other kinds of positions to think about. I find that just like an interesting kind of project. And the other thing I wanted to say that I think is a good frame is in the interview with KSR, which is done by James Bradley, who is also one of the authors in the book. So this is on page 3. I do hate that where the page numbers are in this book. Put page numbers in a normal place. It's still going to look cool.
Oh, normal. What's that, Hillary? Oh, interesting.
I'm gonna be very normative here about page numbers.
Okay. I like them right where my thumb goes, so I always have to move my thumb.
Anyway. So, but Bradley asks this question of KSR that I think is a really good one, and it is one that I think that actually, you know, that like Stan's work just speaks to all the time. But you know, he's saying, you know, okay, the question of how we reimagine our relationship to the future is one you return to often. But in an odd way, aren't these questions about the future the easy ones? Because it's the poisonous legacies of the past, of racism, slavery, colonialism, and extractivism, and their human environmental costs that are really intractable. Can we solve these questions of the future without solving the problems of the past? You know, I wanted to say that, like, I think that sort of question also, which is not something this all the stories in here equally address, but these are stories that I would say most of them are quite committed to not thinking that, I think there actually are a couple of these stories are exceptions to this, but by and large, I think that these stories are interested in being attentive to the idea that we're not going to outlive, the past, right. We're not going to outlive history. And that is very much a part of these kind of everyday life relations that the stories are also interested in.
That history that we live in history, and that it surrounds us, and you know, that we cannot escape it, even if we just decide to be willfully ignorant of it,
right.
and that even learning a lot about it can not necessarily free us from it, but can actually weigh us down even more in certain ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
Depending, I guess, on what your, not only what your attitude is, but how you choose to then live after you know that knowledge. I don't know if that really, you know, plays out in this collection, but it is something to think about. I think, let's see, where should we begin?
Did you have a fave?
Well, I don't know if I had a fave, actually. I asked you about your faves, but I didn't really have. So one of the ones that I really liked that I texted you about as I was reading it was the Once Upon a Future in the West. And I texted you that for an obvious reason.
For an obvious reason.
right away. I mean, not just because it's a Western and I study Westerns, obviously, which also I thought it was really interesting what it did with Westerns. I think the character of, I mean, going back to like those human characters and those kind of really lived in relationships, I thought this was a really interesting story, a really rich story in that regard. But one of the characters is a double person, essentially, like this, he's got these two halves, the gambler and the prospector, which really resonated with me because that was a concept I was working with at a certain point in my dissertation. And shamefully, I didn't resolve it or get back to it, but it actually helped me think about it. But one of the, what happens in the story, is that very similar, again, going back to KSR, there's a kind of market for reputation of people, right? Yeah. There's a, you can like bet on people's Q rating, as if we were in Hollywood, we'd call it a Q rating, whether it goes up or down. And
if we were in Hollywood,
we're not in Hollywood. We're very far away from it. And, but we'd move there if the money is right.
That, yes.
But,
yep.
Talk to my agent, but, the Q rating or the whatever it is the gambler and the prospector are wired into the web, and they get a hot tip on a stock of a celebrity that a video is about to emerge and disrupt their stock price. And the Wall Street code of the celebrity is THX. And then we quickly learn that it's Tom Hanks, our favorite Tom Hanks, and that he is in fact a cannibal, or potentially is a cannibal. And I knew that Hillary would get a kick out of that because she despises Tom Hanks, as we all do.
As any thinking person should. Yeah, this is a very, I haven't read anything else by Daryl Gregory. And like, I think that this is like, this story is a good example of, it's like clever and it's kind of, it's like goofy in some ways. But the pieces of it, so the conceit of it is that we have these characters are all sort of like figures from Westerns, and it takes place in the West. And there's this constant like burning forest fire.
Which is not the only time that kind of thing happens in the collection too. Yeah. There are burning forest fires in multiple stories here that require some amount of mitigation, typically people wearing masks or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And that is one of the things. Yeah. That's one of the things that I think is quite like, I don't know. It's interesting to think that like at this point we're, in terms of being able to distinguish between like the weather and climate or whatever, like we're far enough along that I think that, and I think particularly for people who live in fire prone regions, because like that sort of the breathing in of particulate matter is, just becomes this increasing experience. Right. But I feel like there's a sort of like, for people who are good at writing, there is just like this increasing kind of like, sense of like the density of the experience of the transformation of the climate of what's around you, and the kind of like everydayness of it. And that's something in this story. So we have like the country doctor, we have the gambler / prospector, we have the cowboy, and the, the stories and the sort of play is like, it's a story about like meat in a lot of ways. and the play between those three sections, or those three sort of like, perspectival sections in the story is actually, I think, like quite complicated, like there's like a lot going on and there's a lot to think about. I mean, I really loved I guess this is like a conversation where we don't want to give too much away about stories, since maybe people want to read these and it's easy to just spoil a short story.
Right.
But I really loved the country doctor who, we gradually learn is actually not a doctor, but has this job like basically like doing telehealth. And has this actually like extremely punishing sort of schedule that she has to be able to keep to check in on patients, you know, like all of whom are elderly people experiencing dementia of one kind or another. And one of the sort of like cruxes of the story is that she can't see one of them on video, and she realizes she's going to need to like actually go over to her house. And that like, I don't know. I thought that was like a very like moving part of the story, like both the sense of a lot of these stories are quite good at the like, this is just like how fucked up and depleting it is to work online.
Yeah.
And, you know, here, like, you know, we get this sense of both, like, she knows that she needs to be in person to help this person. And she also kind of knows that even when she gets there, she's not really going to be able to help, because all of this is like in basically like in the context of an insurance sort of situation that is clearly like even worse than the one that we currently live under. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I liked about this story was that feeling of like, you know, it's very funny at parts. It has this whole Tom Hanks thing.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it has a kind of like sneaky, you know, affective weightiness to it too.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. No, it's a lighthearted one. It's one that, I mean, I think going back to what you said at the beginning about you like novels better than short stories, I wouldn't say that I like short stories better than novels, but I'm more sympathetic to them than you are, maybe simply because as a film person, I think films mostly are short stories.
Yeah.
They're not novels.
Yeah.
And like TV series or novels more, you know, but,
yeah.
And so I could really imagine this one, you know, is a very vivid, you know, you could really see it in a 90-minute movie, it had a good vibe that way, but that it had enough. Yeah. Surprising. It had a kind of surprising beats and moments. And then also like the relationships between the characters were really complex and interesting too. I don't know if it's my favorite one. I kind of want to say either Crisis Actors or When the Tide Rises is my favorite.
Mm, those are both really good. Yeah.
What else can we say without spoiling things, without having too many spoilers about stuff?
Yeah. I mean, Crisis Actors is a Greg Egan story that I think in the end is kind of about ideological capture, but trying to do that in a kind of like a twist kind of way, I guess. That one feels hard to talk about without just like actually spoiling the reading of
I really want to talk about it with you, but I don't want to have our listeners be spoiled about, because the experience of reading it is really engaging, I'll say. I want to say difficult, but it's not difficult. It's easy to read, but it's, you have to be on your toes when you're reading it and constantly questioning what you're reading.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And then by the time you get to the end, you want to start it over from the beginning and kind of see how things look.
Yeah. It's a pretty short story. It's one that definitely like, I feel like something that a lot of these stories do, I was saying before we started recording that like something that I think could be kind of, there are two kind of big things that I would love to see a collection like this expand toward thinking about. And one of them is, I think, sort of defaulting to recognizable kind of national boundaries, which not all of these stories do, but sort of in general. I mean, these are partly because they're relatively near future, but we are getting kind of world pictures in which it seems more or less like, you know, the nation state is taken as a kind of default. And the other thing that I really wanted, and I think actually one of the ones that is a little bit different in this regard is the When the Tide Rises story. Something else that I wanted is like more places where the non-human world more places where the non-human world like is more substantively present, right? I mean, so like these are definitely like, I mean, clearly deliberately like very human focused stories. But I kind of think like the question, the sort of, you know, like what does daily life look like? How does it go on questions? Like those aren't necessarily questions that say like that you couldn't have more, you couldn't spend more, a little bit more time in, you know, like the so-called natural world. You know what I mean? Like there are relatively few, maybe there are relatively few animals in these stories, non-human animals. Mm-hmm. There is like relatively little, really kind of like, yeah, there's relatively little sense that something that might change, you know, like in a sort of, you know, just on the other side of like the worst moments of the climate crisis world, which is where I think a lot of these stories kind of are, you know, things have been managed, and in many cases managed by capital simply becoming more rapacious, or by you know, the explosion of certain kinds of VR tech type tech. And, you know, it would be nice to have more that give us a sense that like there might be a transformed, you know, relation, at least of some humans, to the so-called natural world through this. But that the Tide story, which I'm
When the Tide Rises by Sarah Gailey,
it does, because it's an underwater story,
right?
Like I think it does give us like a very kind of intense, you know, we get a like big kind of shift of like our understanding of what it would look like, to be living on in the world. And it is like an interesting like combination of like, you know, fucked up corporate capital in the mode of like, you're going to live in the company town and you're already in debt to the company. And also I think the protagonist in that story who like, it has some there are interesting thoughts in that story also about like, you know, like what eco-terrorism is, and like who would recognize it. But the protagonist of the story has some kind of condition that we take it, I guess, that like a lot of people have, that seems to be environmentally caused, where, you know, her body is degenerated in ways where it is just better for her to be able to live at one of these underwater, live and work underwater. And so her entire goal is to be able to stay basically at this like, you know, kelp farm where she works. And that like, that part is really striking. It's an interesting like move from like these, like, you know, I love Superluminal by Vonda McIntyre, one of my favorite science fiction books, where like people adapt them. One of the kinds of bodily changes that people are making in that book is adapting themselves to be able to live in the water. And there, that's this like really like kind of, you know, it's like a utopian response to understanding that like we don't end at our skin or like something like that. And here it's like she needs to live underwater because it's like too fucking painful to live on Earth. And like, yeah, that's, I really liked that part of it.
Yeah. Gravity, and that she's willing to do pretty much anything for it, including this incredibly owner, like a job that's really impossible to do. She can only work for like a certain amount of time. She makes like very little credits. I mean, there is another really interesting through line throughout this collection about what political economy looks like in the future, especially as capitalism becomes more and more rapacious and companies like Amazon type companies become more and more hegemonic, that the character in When the Tide Rises seems to have, you know, it works for one of these companies, basically a plantation or a prison colony almost, but that she, the condition that her body is in allows her to, you know, and what the company is promising it will do for her if she does X, Y, and Z. I said Z because I'm trying to be fancy, it allows her to like make the bargain with herself. So there's another kind of ideological movie, because then there's this kind of, as you say, this eco-terrorist or terrorist organization. And again, like that definition, who gets to decide what's a, who a terrorist is and not, which again is another kind of KSR question as well. And is terrorism, why do we accept that label of terrorism for certain things and not for people like oil executives, right? Who are clearly the ones doing the damage and keeping us in this state of fear, right? But that kind of sense that like there were that, you know, one thing that really interested me about When the Tide Rises was how our, in contrast to our Elon Musk vision of the future where we're all going to live in space or on Mars. And I think in this one, there are people living in space.
Yeah, I think so.
I know there's a couple of stories where people are living in space, essentially immortal. That's the ferryman, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, the ocean is still this completely untapped reservoir of places to live and work. In our own reality. And as the seas rise, clearly that is going to be that's an open market in a way for not only living and working, but also the prime site of where remediation and reparative work may have to happen. And When the Tide Rises, you know, it pairs interestingly with I Give You the Moon, which also has a kind of Justina Robson, which is a, also has an interesting concept of political economy that is post-capitalist in a way that When the Tide Rises isn't, or is a kind of orthogonal to it in a way, so that rather than being subjected to some kind of exploitative company, the political economy has been gamified to encourage this kind of reparative labor. And then for you to save credits also, and seems like in a very onerous and laborious, slow way of earning these credits that you would then trade in for some kind of like big prize or something like that.
Yeah. I think that the one of the things that I really liked about When the Tide Rises is that I think that it gives us this, you know, it's pretty clear that part of how this corporation that the protagonist works is really precisely through like a version of greenwashing of saying you know, we're the ones who are repairing the oceans. And you know, I think this doesn't spoil it to say that, like, you know, we realize at some point that like she and her, you know, her, because of her disability and because of her, you know, like, because she is thrown back only on herself to cope with her disability and therefore, you know, is willing to do whatever she has to do. Like, you know, this stuff hasn't really occurred to her. And at some point we realize that her coworkers are actually like, you know, they, you know, do not sort of like buy into this in the way that she does. But like for her, there's no outside, you know, there's no outside beyond the company. And she's like shocked to realize that like this supposedly terrorist organization actually constitutes a whole other way of life.
Her disability puts her in a position where she's like not capable of conceiving of an outside. And actually there, you know, whereas because she's so focused on overcoming her disability by submitting to the company, she sees it as the only way. Whereas her other coworkers are free of the disabilities that she has in ways that allow them to be a little bit more critical. Also, one of them was like born there, like never lived anywhere else, so has that kind of nativist critique of a place that, you know. But that they are, you know, that they can recognize things that are going on outside, whereas she is so focused on her own sort of overcoming these understandably overwhelming physical constraints that are just part of her body that she wants to get rid of. And the ending of the story is extremely effective because you just are left sort of in suspended animation, and it's really like powerful.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that was a really good one, and like, you know, quite subtle in certain kinds of ways, and really like does a good job of like evoking like this, like working and living underneath the working and living underneath the sea. Like,
Well, it's interesting too, because the greenwashing aspect, like we're the ones who are cleaning the oceans, you know, it's clear, like the, it she works in this kelp forest, right? And so clearly, like, yeah, the kelp forest is cleaning the ocean. But again, as with all capitalist enterprises, any benefit to the environment is ancillary to the extraction of profit from the laboring masses. And,
right.
you know, that's exactly what she is doing, but also what she can't really focus on because she's so focused on this end goal that's hyper individualized. And so it's a really great image of how sort of capital and the capitalist system work on us to, you know, narrow our focus to individual goals rather than being able to see the big picture.
And I think another thing that I like about the story is that, you know, it understands, I mean, it does something, which is to say that, like, capital is quite good at exploiting vulnerability. I mean, you know, which, as everybody who doesn't quit their job because that's how they have health insurance knows, but you know, it's quite interesting. And I think actually, like, I really liked this move a lot, to rather than trying to think that through by putting, you know, like, how will capital take advantage of the person who has like substantial physical disabilities, rather than imagining that taking place in a virtual scene, she actually does like hard physical labor. Yeah. And that I was really like, I was quite interested in this as like, you know, asking us to think something really pretty hard about sort of embodiment and like bodily possibility, you know, like, because there is this, you know, there is this sense of like, you know, swimming as a form of freedom. Anyway, yeah, I really good story. One that actually, I think that I may teach next quarter, because
I think it's very teachable, especially the ending makes it really teachable.
Oh yeah. And I think it works with my, it works with a bunch of stuff on the syllabus. Cool. I loved the opener to the collection, the Meg Ellison story, which is called Drone Pirates of Silicon Valley. And there are multiple things that I love about this, but I just want to say that one of them is like, she's a really good writer, and she's good at like getting this kind of, so the opening scene of the story is a dad taking his son out to the ballpark, out to a Dodgers game, and they're going specifically because there's a new drone delivery system for hot dogs,
right?
And gradually it's revealed that dad, I mean, and he's characterized, like, the characterization is just like really sharp and like, is done in like a really crisp way that is not annoyingly, I feel like some people who write in the kind of space where this story takes place are extremely stylistically annoying because it has to be like kind of hip or something. And whereas this, I feel like, manages to like do this kind of characterization of him as like this kind of like, you know, Silicon Valley, like, you know, whatever megacorp guy, does it in a real, I mean, he's Jeff Bezos basically. But it's done in like a very, like, I don't know, whatever. There's something that's like very entertaining about it. And it has this, and plus, like, I think, like, you know, this is like a good politics in this story.
Too.
But this scene, I just wanted to like, this is on page 15. So they're there, and they're the whole like the ball game is really negligible compared to the fact that like everybody's come to get the Dodger dog, which is going to be delivered by a drone. This on page 15. Okay, so the drones are coming, and everybody's like super super excited about it. Okay, one of the drones leveled with Elliot. That's the dad. That's the dad's face. Mix Elliot Famberg, please accept 2 e-beef Dodger dogs with mustard, white onion, and celery salt. Elliot took off his cap and stared at the machine. Is Elliot the dad or is Danny the dad? Elliot's the dad, right?
Elliot's the dad. Danny's okay. The kid.
Danny's the kid. All right. Ellie took up his cap and stared at the machine hovering in front of his face. It was about the size of a man's shoe with no visible means of propulsion. Tiny red and green lights blinked on its underside. When its cargo area slid open in a series of Oculus-shaped shells, Elliot nearly jumped back. Inside, two Dodger dogs sat packed together in paper sleeves. Danny could see condensation beating on the inside of the drone from the heat of the food. They both stood there, unsure what to do. The drone repeated itself. It's just like, it's a really good moment of like, because this guy, like the dad, you know, like, he's developing a drone delivery system, and yet faced with the machinic new, with these like, just like very obviously, I mean, you know, like e-beef, but whatever, very obvious hot dogs inside it. Like they're both like, what the fuck are we supposed to do? How do we get our hands in there?
But he's also like more mesmerized by it's the kind of technological sublime of like, he's just staring at the drone and like kind of inspecting it, wondering it sort of how it works and like admiring its design and stuff like that. And meanwhile, there's, you know, earlier on that page, the second ending ended and Danny was certain he was going to starve to death. He waited for his dad to give up and go get a beer. And then he would tell him how badly he needed a plate of overpriced nachos. Like the whole stadium's just waiting. They come for the new drone, not for the Dodger dog, for the drone delivered Dodger dog. And like, they're all starting because it's already been the second inning. It's like, you know, give me is this really easier than flagging down a guy and passing your money along the row and like having the Dodger dog pass along to you? No, it's definitely not.
On the next page, so the machine is like, Danny reached out to take the dogs and the machine neatly fainted away from him. Please do not touch the Dodger dog drone, the tinny voice said, as it gyroscopically kept the dogs level and presented itself once again to Elliot. Mix Famberg, do you wish to cancel your order? And the dad is just like staring at it. And then he says, no, thank you. Thank you. He took the dogs as gently as one would pick up a baby bird in lightly curved.
I mean, it's so dumb.
It's hilarious.
It's very funny. And then the rest of the story is about these drones that are basically everywhere that, I guess it's the Babazon company, right?
Babazon, yeah.
Has mastered the art of drone delivery finally, and drones are delivering everything to everybody all over the place all the time. And Danny, the son of, is Elliot like the president of the company or is he just an exec? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So Elliot, the son of the scion of the Babazon empire, and his two friends, develop ways to knock some of these drones out of the sky and steal stuff. Basically, they become pirates. And yeah, the class politics is really great in this one because you have three people of kind of different socioeconomic statuses, and they're also young people. They're also high school aged friends, basically, who have varying experiences of the world because of their class status, and therefore have varying experiences or desires. It, as regards to becoming sort of drone pirates, what are they going to do with this thing? And the piracy aspect, of course, is really fun and crucial and interesting, because also it again, going back to questions of political economy, it opens on to other themes throughout the other short stories in the collection as well, about how you live outside of the official economy, how subaltern people make their living, do their lifing outside of the bounds of, and try to escape the confines of sort of the wage labor system.
Right. And about, I mean, the dogs nestled in the drones and like the visibility of the drones, it is like a lot of these stories about like the world you see and the life worlds that you don't.
Right.
See, and I mean, and I think here both the implication of like sort of the necessity of, the necessity of a displaced subproletariat, or just, I guess this is just like the proletariat, right? To corporations like this, right? And at the same time, like ongoing resistance, like just on the terrain of the everyday. And it, you know, when we see the other, when we get the sort of glimpse of the other world through Danny's eyes, like he doesn't even really know how to interpret what he's seeing, because like it doesn't look like the fantasies that he has about people who live outside the system. It doesn't really look like he expects at all. And we, there's a line about him just like not even being sure where it's okay for him to look while he's there, that I think is really, it's a really good story. I think it's a super satisfying story that, again, like a lot of these, it manages to do a lot, in a short space, it manages to do quite a lot.
Yeah.
And to do really satisfying, like give you a satisfying feeling of like, you know, science fictional estrangement, like along the way.
Yeah. The following story, Down and Out in Exile Park, I think does the same thing, pairing really well, like in that kind of like, again, subaltern or exterior zone that, you know, like for folks who are uncritical of capitalism or haven't even considered like trying to step outside of it and look and see the question of how you live outside of the system, or if that's even life, right? Yeah. If that is even living, doesn't, you know, like for Danny, doesn't dawn on you until something weird happens. And here, something really weird in Down and Out in Exile Park by Tade Thompson, some really weird stuff happens. And it's very cool because most of the story takes place in a floating island of plastic off the coast of Nigeria. And that floating island of plastic is like inhabited like very richly by like an untold number of people. It's not really clear how many, but that also that there is a, so they've created a whole kind of separate society that is, it's called Exile Park. So it feels to those on the mainland, those in the official economy, as a kind of, again, like kind of a pirate ship or kind of like outer world or something like that. But within it, when the first person protagonist enters into it, you find this like rich world that is full, you know, full of life and full of like new other ways to live that aren't beholden to the system, that actually do promise, hold out a kind of possibility of life itself, not life under capitalism, but what life would be in a way, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think that one of the things I think that Thompson does really well in this story is to, and he does this, this is maybe the story where this happens kind of like the most, like he really wants you to think about like these questions about like the residual, right? And when the residual sort of like takes the form of waste. And there's this weird moment partway through when we learn that there actually is now biotech, a bacterium of some kind that can digest plastic, right? So then we realize that like this floating plastic island is like, you know, which for us is the kind of like signifier, you know, when we think about like those, you know, is obviously like a sort of signifier of like future doom. Here actually weirdly like becomes the place that is held onto, you know, by the outcasts, right? You know, in fact, they're imperiled by a kind of technology that can get rid of plastic. You know, which I think is, and sort of like central to this story is that like, you know, on this floating plastic island in this world is like a sort of oracle or goddess figure, who's like represented, like, you know, when you go to the oracle at Delphi and you like get high off the fumes or whatever, you know, like, it's like really great, like a really great and crazy. And it, and like both, I mean, I think, this seems like I've read another novel by Thompson, and I feel like this is kind of something that he does. Like, it's both like very dense and also like he leaves parts unexplained, in a way that in this story is actually, I found very, very satisfying. Like, I was really into that kind of back and forth between like we're getting so much detail and also like, wait, what? What's happening? Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Well, again, I think this is another really teachable short story because of that ambiguity between this oracle and the kind of, on the one hand, on the oracle, and then on the other hand, the sense of community that it, that exists in Exile Park. So that there's this tension between, well, are we all here because the oracle is, we're high on the fume, on the pheromones of this kind of like post-human oracle or this kind of like mutant or something like that. Or is this a society? Like, have we created society here where it, it can be held together somehow, where we're, you know, not free of crime, but that, that there are, we have systems of our own, kind of an anarchist commune type thing. Like we have systems of our own to handle it, that we're existing outside of or next to or separate from the official economy, and that you know, that this is a real thing. It's not just a parasitic onto something else like capitalism is, but in fact this is the real, you know, way to live or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And the fact that that would be the real thing to live and you're on a plastic island,
yeah,
is so kind of counterintuitive and juicy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, it's great. And I think for this sort of like, you know, just the like, I like this story because it just like, it lets things be quite messy, you know, and it raises, I mean, so the, you know, the narrator and his wife and kid, you know, go to Exile Island, and we have this sort of setup of the mystery and also the setup of, you know, they're like professionals and they're like bringing expert knowledge in, and like the daughter's taking photos. So there's this whole sort of sense of like, oh, you know, they're the objective outsiders with like, you know, real like scientific knowledge of some kind. But we really don't get a sort of opposition between like, I don't know, like mystical irrationality and scientific knowledge, or even really a sort of inside outside opposition. Instead, it becomes about like, you know, just this sort of their own encounter with like the limits of how they live. And then like, yeah, as like you were saying, like a glimpse of like this whole world that actually is functional.
I think this is something that I really like about the collection as a whole, is that the complexity of the lives of all of these, of the characters you find throughout the book, mm-hmm. in all of the different stories, is not a simple, there's no simple real dichotomies between, you know, nature, technology, culture, you know, it's they're messy in the way that life is messy, and that only, the only clean thing is like, not necessarily ideology, but you know, when you try to write something down and account for it scientifically, yeah. That's how you make something clean and ideal. And like the lived reality of, and that we're always, you know, and that's something also to keep in mind, and that we draw from KSR a lot too, is that we're always inside and outside of capitalism. We're always straining against it. There's always around us pockets that mm-hmm. are escaping it or being left out by it or being victimized by it or benefiting from it or whatever, that this is a system in motion constantly, that you're constantly sort of unsettled by, and that you have to ask questions about at all times. I feel like that goes throughout the collection. And I think that like Down and Out in Exile Park, I think that our discussion of that kind of opens onto really nicely, how do you hear the fungi sing?
Yeah.
By Chen
Wild,
Qifeng,
wild ass story.
Which a completely wild story that we wouldn't be able to do justice to, I think. But that has that aspect of, you know, the kind of the kind of ideology of scientific modernity that we're all very used to and comfortable in, that we're using right now to talk into our microphones over 1,000 miles separating us and beaming this out to the weirdos who listen to it. we take to be the normal, or we take to be how everybody ought to live or whatever. And here in Do You Hear the Fungi Sing, we have this kind of other society that is sort of, I guess you'd say pre-modern. I don't know what to do with this story. This story, yeah, is really
it's a weird one, man.
weird, and I want to say problematic, not in a bad way, but in a way that makes me really want to think more about it. Because is there a romantic attitude to this pre-modern society that the main character finds herself in? Are we meant to, you know, be wistful about the loss of these pre-modern societies in the face of a kind of global technological network that, you know, that is a hyper global surveillance state? Or are we meant to see them as compatible somehow, as one being built on top of the other, but unknowingly? Can they like live together? Yeah. Can they learn from each other? It opens onto lots of questions that it doesn't have the answers for, and in a good way, not in a bad way, like Alien 4 does.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an interesting story. I think, you know, like my feeling is that there are things, because it's a Chinese story. I think is it the only translated story in the collection?
Yeah.
My feeling is that there are probably like there are things that we would read differently if we were more knowledgeable about the sort of context in which it's being written, I think. You know what I mean? That's my feeling about a lot of Chinese SF that's getting translated, is that like, it's fascinating. It does a ton. It's not like you can't like, you know, it's not like you can't read it as a like, you know, white Euro-American person. But it is the case also. And part of this I've like learned, because I've had a couple of Chinese students who I've advised MA theses on science fiction, who have like talked with me a lot about things that like I completely am missing in the text that they're talking about, just because it's like, you know, it's like, you know, deep sort of like milieu stuff that like I, you know, I don't know. But anyway, so I'm sure it would look kind of different there. It's interestingly like an interesting sort of variant on that Jeff Ryman novel Air that is a, I don't, have you read that?
No. I don't read, you know this.
True. That's right. I forgot that about you. Literally cannot read. It's amazing. It's amazing how we've gotten through this podcast.
I can read. I just choose not to.
I think Air is a really, I mean, Jeff Ryman's a complicated SF writer, but I think Air is a really interesting book that does, an extremely complicated novel that sort of takes on at least the apparent form of the kind of like the Oriental tale, as in the sort of like 18th century form. I think ultimately like it's like, it is quite critical of the point of the book is sort of to be critical of that, that mode. But it also is about like a little town culturally distinct from what's around it, where, you know, when the state arrives to say like, oh, we're going to install this weird kind of internet here that like goes directly into your head. And the sort of combination of like lifeways and like spiritual stuff and like, anyway, whatever. It's a really interesting book. I think you would enjoy it. I think it's worth reading. And this story does some of the same kinds of things. And yeah, like it's really hard to know like how you're supposed to position yourself, like whether this is supposed to be about loss. It has great stuff about mushrooms and fungi in it. And again, like a central goddess figure. And in the middle of the story, there's like a long, like there's a long poem, you know, that retells a sort of like folktale, which I love as a sort of insertion. And then there's like a fantastic, like, you know, kind of shamanic trip that our like tech girl main character takes that brings her into contact, you know, with the goddess probably, right? Or something, you know. Yeah, really interesting, weird story. Don't totally know what to make of it.
Yeah. And then I think the only one we really haven't touched on Legion, which is kind of like a Joe Rogan experience, but underwater. Again, underwater it happens. Yeah. and a kind of representative of a kind of crowdsourced communal defense network that operates on not just hyper surveillance, but omni surveillance takes place. And it's kind of troubling, actually.
Yeah, I found it a very cynical story, I thought.
Okay. Yeah.
But
and then The Ferryman, which we mentioned, which is about escaping death. And like, it's got some good, again, I'm not going to say, I don't want to say anything about it. And we're going to probably just wrap up soon and keep it as a short episode. But I'm impressed that we spoke about every story.
Oh, we haven't talked about the last one.
Either. I know, I'm saving it. But The Ferryman has a great 50s science fiction trope. Like 50s
yes.
movie science fiction trope yes. that I wouldn't spoil for anybody because it's a nice surprise.
Yeah, no, that's an A plus moment in that
A
story.
Plus moment. Really good. It's just yeah. But then After the Storm is a really affecting, and this is what this is another thing that I meant when I was talking about at the beginning about like very human stories, very lived in, and very much still about the fact that human relationships, you know, there's this, you know, it's not hope punk, it's not doom scrolling. The end of the world is not going to happen unless it does because of nuclear winter. But like if nuclear winter doesn't happen and climate change just takes its course, unfortunately, for many people listening, human beings are still going to be around. Like you're still going to have all your fucked up problems and you're still going to have to find a job or a new one, mm-hmm. right? And here in After the Storm, the main characters are, again, high school students, high school yeah. kids who are dealing with all the same things that high school kids do today under Capitol, which is they have absent parents, they tease each other, their hormones are firing off. They're getting drunk and stoned in places they shouldn't be because they're places to escape, you know, the overlooking eye of their parents or parental figures. And shit happens and they have to like grow up in that shit. Right. Yeah. And so like, it's a really cool story.
Yeah. It's a very sad story. And I would say that it like, despite the fact that I think as you just captured, like it absolutely could be a story that was just like set in the year 2022 in like wherever, you know, like down and out place.
Oh no, it's in Southern Australia.
It's in
right?
Australia. Yeah. yeah. In whatever down and out place in Australia. I still think it's moving and like the kind of, and the sense in it that I think is, it's another one where we have a sense, and this is part of its bleakness, I think, is that like the kind of the sort of ecological restoration stuff that they're trying to do is like, it's not hopeless, but it's not very hopeful, you yeah. know, and the water is rising,
the water
you know,
is rising, yeah.
And that part of it, like, which I mean, I don't know. I'd have to think about it more to think about whether I think that that is more backdrop or whether that's kind of like essential to the relations that we see. But it still is like a moving, you know, and very much in the middle of like thinking. I mean, I see like when you're trying to think about like displacement, like it makes a lot of sense to want to reach for characters who are teenagers too, right? People who feel displaced just like anyway, partly because they are displaced because like, you know, the world hates the energy and passion of adolescence, you know, like, and is freaked out by teenagers. So that, and because, you know, like being a teenager is about feeling like you don't belong and you stick out and like you have nothing. And, you know, so I, you know, the sort of there's something very affecting about using that to try to think about a place where like everything has been taken away from people, you know. And this, I think also that story, like the subtlety of the central familial situation is like quite, is very painful and like, yeah.
And it captures too, another thing it kind of captures is, and I think it maybe not uniquely among the collection, but it stands out more as this teenage character is trying to make sense of her world, figuring out who to blame, where fault lies.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? Like, is it anybody's fault? Is it just the way things are? Do I blame myself? Do I blame this person or that person? And trying to navigate that kind of sense of who's responsible for all of this? Where does responsibility lie? And how do I, place myself within that network of responsibility? I think, again, is like a really another great sort of thing that short stories do in a really impactful way that's very sort of teachable and, like, you know, open to discussion.
Yeah. And taking the question about, like, you know, is there action to be taken and can the individual take it? I mean, in some ways, the Greg Egan story that we didn't really talk about, like, is definitely a story about, like, the sort of, you know, the ideology of, like, thinking that, like, there is somebody responsible, and also thinking that, like, you know, you should, you as the individual should take responsibility for your own actions. Like,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Or that, and that you can do something about, you as an individual and should do something about it.
Yeah.
Because you're a good person.
Yeah, exactly. It's the only one probably that sort of, like, invokes the kind of, like, the sort of conspiratorial mindset that seems to be, like, you know, at least our very current conjuncture seems to be, like, quite marked by
so hot right now. So
it's hot right now. Yeah, exactly.
We would be remiss if we didn't mention the artwork, though.
Yeah,
by Sean Bodley, who did the cover and also the drawings that precede each chapter.
Yeah.
Which are really charming and evocative and like lovely. And Sean Bodley also has a little artist statement basically at the end. I don't mean to diminish it by calling it little, but it is only 2 pages.
Short, yeah.
I'm not being dismissive, because I think that that statement is really great too, because Sean makes a real case for, you know, the future is also going to be art. You know, we're going to, you know, beating climate change or beating capitalism or creating a new world is going to be done using art, not just technology, not just weapons, not science, but art.
Yeah. I agree. I really like the drawings. His little trees are really great. And I feel like, you know, in a better world, one would have this book with, like, a really great portfolio of somewhat bigger versions of these images, like, you know, in the center of it to really browse through. But I like that is part of, you know, I like that's part of, without being illustration-y, that's sort of, like, part of how the... that, like, that's taken seriously as part of the book.
They don't illustrate the stories. They're their own thing.
Yeah.
Is it Bodley or Bodley?
I don't know.
I pronounce it both ways. Sean, I apologize. I have a last name that also people mispronounce, and I'm sure you can identify with that.
he can now. I was psyched about this collection. It was super fun to read. This is, like, our most book review-y episode that we've ever
done. It is. We're so efficient about it. It's incredible. Yeah. Think that we should have a whole new format for the show.
Well, see, if people would just keep giving us gifts of, well, no, I don't want them.
I know. I have a lot of books here to read that are clogging up my whole life. So I got to read them, get rid of them, and then start a new life somewhere else.
Yeah, new life begins after you've finished reading those books. I'm excited to talk about Everything for Everyone with you, because I think that is just a fantastic, really moving, great book. And also because it's always really fun to talk with you, Matt.
Hillary, likewise. And I hope our listeners have felt the same way. The listeners of this podcast, Marooned on Mars with Matt and Hillary, which you can reach us at Gmail, at podcastonmars@gmail.com, or at Twitter, which may not exist anymore soon because of the nuclear bomb that is Elon Musk, or the nuclear bombs that may go off any minute now.
When people are saying that Twitter's not going to exist anymore, it'll be funny if when this comes out, Twitter already doesn't exist anymore. But like, I literally don't understand whether they are like wishing it away or saying we got to leave because Elon Musk is so gross, or whether or
it is it's
or I mean, saying it's going to break. Is that what it is?
There's a kind of isomorphic quality there between the doom scrolling, like the world is coming to an end and Twitter is coming to an end. Like no yeah. matter how much you wish those two things away, even though you have like a kind of a cruel optimism feeling toward exactly. that, those two eventualities, yeah. Yeah. they're probably not going to happen. But I think the fear is that it's just going to be, I think the fear is that it's going to be taken over either taken over by the far right, like all the, or advertisers are going to flee so much that it won't be economically viable anymore, which I feel like it wasn't economically viable right. in the first place anyway. Like all tech companies, it did always feel like a Ponzi scheme. Yep. Like, how are you making money off of this?
Yeah, exactly.
And, or that it is, the other theory that's out there is that Elon is intentionally tanking it because to shut down political speech or something like that, which is,
yeah,
I agree with the laughter because there is no political speech in America. Like I mean, we are fully captured by like, where do people go? Like I could make more of an impact by going out to the town square and standing on a milk crate and screaming than I can like posting something on the internet.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Or writing a letter to the editor of my local newspaper. Like what?
I mean, also I just don't like, I don't think Elon Musk is like really that strategic, you know, no. He just wants to sell his things. Right.
Well, that's the clear thing. And now we should like really stop and have a bonus episode where we just talk shit about Elon Musk because this is boring, but his big plan to monetize Twitter is to have people subscribe for $8 a month to get their blue checks, which somebody did the math and that would mean that Twitter would make $7 million a year and you just paid $44 billion for it. I mean, let's just focus on the fact that we live in the obscenity of the society that we live in, where a man can spend $44 billion on anything that doesn't do anything at all to alleviate the massive suffering that half of the world's population live under, and that the other half of the world's population just barely get by.
Yeah.
So fucking repulsive. And I don't know if it's in this interview with Kim Stanley Robinson or the recent one in Jacobin where they discuss the euthanasia of the rentier class that he floats from, yeah. that he gets from Keynes, that he floats in Ministry for the Future. Obviously that's a metaphor, the euthanasia of the rentier class. We want to just expropriate their wealth and like put it to the public good. But in any case where you wouldn't want the euthanasia to be metaphorical, it would be Elon Musk. And if you can parse that, what I just said, I'll probably be in jail tomorrow.
So. Well, it's a good thing that only 300 people listen to this podcast.
If that, I mean, most of them are probably Twitter bots.
And some of them, yeah, probably only a minority of them are feds.
I don't think any of them are going to rat me out. They're on my side.
Yeah.
Well, thank you to who sent us the book, Jessica?
Her name is Jessica Pellion.
Jessica Pellion at MIT Press. Thank you, MIT Press. And thank you, Jonathan Strahan, for editing the book and all of the writers for writing it. And thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon.
You can catch us on Mastodon, and we'll be back soon.
We're never going to be on Mastodon.
For the next book that we are reading,
real
is
Mastodon.
We're going to bring them back from the dead and then eat them up, and that's going to solve world hunger.
Oh, well, I was thinking riding them.
Well, we could do that too.
Okay.
The next book we're reading is Everything for Everyone, an Oral History of the New York Commune. And then there's years, I can't remember, like 2049 to 2073 or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's by Emmy O'Brien and the other author,
Iman Abdelhadi.
Iman Abdelhadi. And it's fantastic. So buy it, read it, and then listen to us, because there will be spoilers in that episode when we get around to it in a couple of weeks.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's on Common. It's published by Common Notions, which is a really cool press.
Yeah.
By the way. I'm not being paid by Common Notions. I've just looked at their website.
And we were only given this book by MIT Press, but I do recommend it if it is your thing. And if you're listening to this, it probably is. So.
All right. Good job.
Bye. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. Bye.